So I've already talked a little bit about this slide 13 information, but that's where we ended. I can't remember exactly how far I got, but I want to say that when it comes to covalent bonds, it's important to keep in mind that one covalent bond consists of two electrons, not one. It's not one electron that's shared. It's always two, because each of the two atoms involved shares one of its own electrons. Therefore, two electrons or one pair gets shared. And if it's just a single pair, then that covalent bond is called a single covalent bond. That's happening with hydrogen here. But it's also possible to form what are called double covalent bonds, and even though not shown here, even triple covalent bonds. And this brings up, again, the notion of valence. Remember what the definition of valence is? What is valence for any given atom? That's right. It's how many more electrons you would have to add to that atom in order to fill whatever its valence shell is. Now, practically speaking, you can think of that as how far from the right edge is that element on the periodic table? Because the right edge represents a full outer shell, right? Our valence shell. Well, notice hydrogen, even though it's way over on the left, is still only one step away from the right, because there's only two in that row or period. So that's a practical way of seeing that hydrogen has a valence of one. But how also, without even looking at a periodic table, do you know that the hydrogen valence is one? Well, what is its valence shell? Which shell in hydrogen is the valence shell? Well, that's true for any. That just means what the valence shell is. For specifically for hydrogen, what is its valence shell? Don't ever overthink this. Yeah, go ahead and say it. Right. Shell 1 is hydrogen's valence shell. It only has one electron, right? So that occupies the lowest shell, which is shell 1. And what is the capacity of shell 1? It can hold at most 2. Now, why is 2 the maximum for shell 1? There aren't two orbitals. There is one orbital. Well, let's talk about the subspace, all the spaces again. Shell 1 is a space, right? How many subshells are in shell 1? No? Just one. What's it called? It's not called the S orbital. It's called the S subshell. Right? The S subshell contains all of the S orbitals in that shell. How many S orbitals make up the S subshell? One. And that's true for each level. Each level has its own S subshell consisting of one S orbital in that subshell. Okay? Now, how many P orbitals are in the P subshell? Three, if there is such a thing as a P subshell. Is there a P subshell in shell one?
No.
No. So the entire shell for shell one consists of exactly one total orbital, right? The 1s orbital. That's why the total capacity for shell one is 2, because it's made up of only one orbital, and any orbital, regardless of type, can contain at most 2 electrons. So 8 is not the special number for shell 1. 2 is. And so how do you explain, therefore, in words, that hydrogen has a valence of 1?
Because it has only one orbital and it's only one.
Well, use the definition of valence that we've been using. What is the valence? Okay, so use that to explain why the valence of hydrogen is one. It has one electron. Keep going. It only needs one more to get to two, which is the full shell for shell one, right? Now, practically speaking, on the periodic table, you can think of that as being just one step away from the right edge. Same thing for oxygen, except it's in period two, which corresponds to shell two, right? How many subshells are in shell two? I couldn't hear. Did someone say a numeral? Two. What are they? We're talking about subshells.
The 1s subshell and the 2s?
No. No shell contains 2s subshells. Or two different s subshells, I should say. Also, shell 2 doesn't contain anything labeled as 1. Because the 1 means shell 1.
Shell 2 has the 3p?
Those are not subshells. Those are orbitals.
Oh.
Yeah, go ahead. There's the 2s subshell. That's one subshell. What's the other one? The p subshell of shell 2. Okay? And it's called the P subshell because it contains all of the P's in that shell. So how many S orbitals in shell 2? No, there's never two S orbitals in the same shell. Yes. It's called the 2S orbital. The 2 just means it's shell 2. But it's one orbital. How many p orbitals? Three different p orbitals make up the p subshell in shell 2, and that's true for every shell except number 1, because from 2 upward, they all have their own p subshell that contains their own 3 p orbitals. Okay, so how many total orbitals in shell 2? No. We just... it's not three.
Four.
Four is correct. But it's sounding like this is guesswork.
No, it's because... I'll answer. It's because there's one orbital, which is the 2s orbital, and then there's the 3 2p orbitals. So 3 plus that 1 equals 4.
Exactly. That's perfect. So 4 total orbitals in shell 2, whereas shell 1 has only one orbital, period. Okay, therefore, what's the capacity for shell 2?
Eight
at most, yes. 8 electrons will fill the second shell, which oxygen is in. Oxygen's valence shell is shell 2. It needs 8. Its valence shell has 6, because it's the 6th one in that row going left to right in that period. But also, you can see it's 2 steps from being to the right edge. So oxygen has a valence of 2. But to explain it based on the definition of valence, you would say that oxygen needs 2 more electrons to get to 8, which is full for that shell. 8 minus 6 is 2. The valence is 2. Okay? Now, we talked about the Lewis dot diagrams, and remember that the symbol for the element, O in this case, represents the atomic nucleus, where the neutrons and protons are. We don't bother to draw non-valence electrons at all, because they're not the ones involved in chemical reactions. They're lower toward the nucleus. So only the valence electrons are represented as dots. And this is the second shell for oxygen that's the valence shell. We can tell that because it's period two. We know that there are six in that, but since it's shell two, as we've just gone through, there are four orbitals to work with, right? So we start filling those orbitals. We start distributing electrons one at a time to different orbitals until we run out of orbitals. That's these four dots. Because top is one orbital, bottom is another, left and right are all the four orbitals. When all orbitals are half filled, then we start doubling up until we run out of electrons. That's five, and then that would be six. Now, it doesn't matter which sides the pairs are on. This is the same thing as what's written here. But that diagram shows you schematically that oxygen's valence is two. Because the valence is how many more it needs to fill that shell. It needs one here and it needs one here. Okay? That's why the valence is two. But practically speaking, you can think of the valence of a nonmetal, which oxygen is, as being the number of covalent bonds it has to make, if it's going to be a part of a molecule, to be stable. Just like the noble gases. And that's what all the atoms that make up molecules are trying to do. They're trying to be like one of these noble gases by satisfying their own valences. All right? So you can see here that oxygen isn't going to be satisfied unless it gets credit for two more electrons. And I say get credit for because it's not that you're going to create two new electrons and give it to oxygen by for itself. It's going to get credit for them if something else shares its electron with oxygen. Right? When there's a sharing in a covalent bond of a pair of electrons, then both of those atoms actually get credit for both of those shared electrons. Which is why each atom is actually, it seems like it has one more electron than it does. Because one of the two, it was its to begin with. It gets credit for that, plus it gets credit for the one that is really the original property of the other atom. Well, if oxygen makes a single covalent bond, it's not going to be satisfied. Because that's only going to give it credit for one more. So the valence determines how many covalent bonds that particular atom has to make if it's going to be a member of a molecule. And keep in mind that molecule means that structure is made with covalent bonding, not with ionic bonding. So it's nonmetals and other nonmetals in covalent bonding. Well, hydrogen has a valence of one, and any molecule that it's going to be part of is going to involve one covalent bond that hydrogen is part of. Just like in hydrogen molecule, hydrogen gas, H2. Each of these individual hydrogen atoms has a valence of one. They share their one electron with each other. They both get credit for both. The bond itself contains both of those electrons, but each of them gets credit for two, which makes it satisfied just like helium. Not going to make any more bonds. It's already satisfied. Oxygen is never going to make one, though, because that's not going to satisfy it. So when you get two oxygen atoms together, they each need credit for two. Therefore, they don't just share one pair, they share two pairs. Four overall molecules make up a double bond. That satisfies both oxygens. Each oxygen is making two bonds because a double bond really counts as two. But in any molecule, not just a molecule of oxygen, any molecule in which oxygen is one of the atoms, that oxygen atom has to be making two bonds. Either either one double covalent bond or two single covalent bonds. They both count as two. And you see that in water, for instance. H2O It stops there, doesn't become bigger because oxygen's forming two bonds to satisfy its valence. But in that case, it's forming two single bonds, one with each of two different hydrogens. And notice, in the same molecule, each hydrogen is forming one molecule equal to its own valence. Does that all make sense? There can even be a triple bond, as I said. We can do this same Lewis thing with nitrogen. Symbol is N. How many valence electrons does nitrogen have? No and no.
Can you repeat the question?
How many valence electrons does nitrogen have? Well, let's actually start a little before that. What is the valence shell of nitrogen?
Second,
just like oxygen. It's in the same period, right? Well, if you go from left to right in that period, it's the fifth element, right? So it has five valence electrons. It also has two others that are in the first shell, but it has five in the second shell. That's why it's the fifth in that period. Five is three away from being eight, and you can see also that it's three steps from the right edge. So Lewis dot diagram wise, we would start with the N. We have five electrons to distribute. We put four of them in individual in the same four orbitals that oxygen has. But now we're done when we just add one more pair and have just one pair. That pair of electrons is going to stay the property of that nitrogen. It's not going to be shared. These three that are unpaired are the ones that have to be shared. Okay, it's the half-filled orbitals that are involved in covalent bonding. And so a nitrogen in any molecule that it's part of is going to be making three bonds, either three individual single covalent bonds, a double and a single, or a triple. Since any nitrogen has a valence of three, if you have two nitrogens together, they form a triple covalent bond, six total electrons, right? Plus the two that each nitrogen has permanently, that brings it to eight for each of them. Well, I've already told you that a covalent bond of any type is much stronger than an ionic bond, right? They're both chemical bonds, but covalent bonds are much stronger. Within covalent bonds, though, double bonds are stronger than single bonds, and triple bonds are even stronger. In fact, this particular bond, this triple bond between nitrogen atoms in a nitrogen molecule, N2, has particular importance in biology because every organism absolutely requires nitrogen. You can't have a protein without nitrogen, and so it doesn't even make sense to think of life without nitrogen. Everything needs it. And it's, at least for things that are exposed to the air, like we are as terrestrial organisms, it's all around us. Three-quarters of the air is pure nitrogen. But almost no organisms on Earth can use that as their nitrogen source. Because almost no organisms on Earth are able to break that strong triple bond to get nitrogen atoms. Only certain bacteria are able to do that, and the rest of the world relies on those bacteria for their life. Despite the, you know, it's kind of like being in the middle of the ocean, water everywhere, but not water that you can drink. Thank you. I think so too. Okay, so just keep in mind that every bond is two. So a triple bond is really six electrons. A double bond is four electrons. And we can draw them with dots like this, but if we look at slide 14, there's other ways we can draw them as well. For instance, instead of drawing a pair of dots to represent a single covalent bond, like between hydrogen and a hydrogen molecule here at the top, we can just draw a single dash. Just always remember that one dash represents actually two electrons. But it's a single... The nice thing about one dash, not only is that easier to draw, but it tells you that it's a single bond. Whereas a double dash is two... It's a double bond. It really counts as two bonds, but that's four overall electrons if you have two dashes. And so on. The space-filling models don't really tell us much. They're just pretty. The electron distribution diagrams involve those shell circles that we were using before for individual atoms, but when you get atoms together, overlaps of their shells can indicate that they're sharing certain electrons. Now to 15. We've talked about two major categories of chemical bonds. What are they? Ionic and covalent. And I don't want to say those are the only two categories. They're just two categories that we care about in this course. But they're chemical bonds, first of all. What makes them a chemical bond? Or either one of them, a chemical bond? Or what makes any given bond a chemical bond? Yes, if a chemical bond forms, then you no longer have the same stuff. You have new substance with its own properties different from the properties of the stuff you started with. Not all bonds are like that. And we'll talk about ones that aren't like that very soon. But back to the two categories we've been talking about, ionic and covalent, two major categories. But I'm going to subdivide the covalent category into two subcategories of covalent bonds. And those two categories are polar covalent bonds and nonpolar covalent bonds. Any given covalent bond is, of course, a sharing of electrons. That's what makes it covalent. But any given covalent bond is either polar or nonpolar. Not both. So, like I said, there's sharing, of course, because we're talking about covalent bonds here. There has to be sharing for it to be covalent. But just in life, any given sharing relationship doesn't have to be an equal sharing relationship, right? And that's what makes the difference between polar and nonpolar. A nonpolar covalent bond is an arrangement in which the pair of electrons that are shared is equal sharing between the two atoms involved. What that means is that the time spent around each of the two atomic nuclei that those electrons spend, the shared electrons, is pretty equal. You're just as likely to find at any given moment the electrons around one atomic nucleus than the other, as the other. Well, there can still be sharing, even if it's unequal sharing. And that's what happens in a polar covalent bond. And by unequal sharing, I mean that the shared electrons actually end up spending more time around one of the two atomic nuclei, one around one atom, than the other. They do spend time around both. But in a polar covalent bond, the shared electrons are usually, more often than not, around one of the two atoms. And so that's pretty easy to understand just on common sense terms, but it brings up the question of why there would be unequal sharing. And that has to do with a property that any given element has, or every given element has a value of this property, which is called electronegativity. So every given element has a value for electronegativity, but the electronegativity as a property is how attractive it is for electrons. In other words, how greedily it wants to keep those electrons for itself, even when they're shared. And the higher the value is for electronegativity, the more greedy that type of atom is. And it's not a perfect trend, but there's a general trend on the periodic table, if you exclude the noble gases, which are nice and satisfied. Electronegativity values are low in the lower left corner of the periodic table for those elements, and they get bigger and bigger as you go to the upper right, except for the noble gases. And look where fluorine is, right there in the corner. It has the highest electronegativity of any element. It really wants electrons for itself, which makes it really reactive, by the way. That's why it reacts with so many things. But even though it's highest, oxygen is pretty close. It's right next door to fluorine. Oxygen, which we find in all the biological macromolecules, has a high electronegativity compared to most other things, including hydrogen. Hydrogen's way over here on the left, much lower electronegativity than oxygen. So hydrogen-oxygen bonds you find in all kinds of molecules. They'll easily bond to each other covalently, which by definition is a sharing of a pair of electrons. But because of the drastic difference in the values of electronegativity for oxygen compared to hydrogen, that sharing is pretty unequal. And whenever you have two atoms that differ highly in their electronegativity values forming a covalent bond, not only is it a polar covalent bond, but the atom that has the higher value of electronegativity wins out, in a sense, when it comes to having custody of the electrons more often than not. So the electrons that are shared are spending more time around the atom with the higher electronegativity value. This is a water molecule, if you don't already know that, an oxygen bonded to two hydrogens. Notice, by the way, back to what we were saying before, oxygen has a valence of 2, and you notice that it's making 2 bonds to be satisfied. Each hydrogen has a valence of 1. Each hydrogen is making 1 bond. But anyway, back to the polar nature of this. There are 2 bonds. Each bond is separate, but they're identical to each other because each one involves an oxygen and a hydrogen. In each of the cases, oxygen's electronegativity is much higher than the hydrogen's, so it wants the electrons for itself more so than the hydrogen does, and the electrons spend more time around the oxygen end of that bond. Well, electrons themselves individually are negatively charged, right? Each one has a full charge, but this is a sharing of electrons, so that full charge isn't always with oxygen. It's just more often than not. And therefore, that gives the oxygen end of the bond a slightly, but not fully, negative charge. And this delta, the lowercase Greek d, indicates that it's not a full charge. Delta minus means partially negative at that end of the bond, And the hydrogen end is slightly positive because those negative electrons aren't there very often. Now, the word polar simply refers to anything that has two ends that are different. And here, it has to do with the difference in how often the electron is there. Or the electrons, because it's a pair that's shared. A nonpolar covalent bond is nonpolar because the two ends are not different from each other. They're equally shared electrons. So they have equal likelihoods of the electrons being there. Now, what about an oxygen molecule? Like we were talking about in the previous slide with the O's coming together to form O2. Is an oxygen molecule going to be polar or nonpolar? It is going to be nonpolar. Why? That's right. Oxygen is a really greedy molecule because it has a very high electronegativity. Each one individually in that molecule really wants the electrons for itself. But the other one's just as greedy. They have identical electronegativities when it's the same atom. So no one wins out, even though they're both fighting for it, in a sense. So yes, an oxygen molecule is nonpolar, therefore. Doesn't have a partial charge on one end and an opposite partial charge on the other, like each bond in a water molecule does. So if a molecule, which by definition is something made of covalent bonds, features polar covalent bonds, then we call the whole molecule polar. And if not, it's nonpolar. Water is a polar molecule. And that fact alone allows you to exist. I mean, that is enough to have caused for life to have evolved. That has so many implications, the polarity of water, that it has allowed the conditions for life to have evolved. And that's exactly why when we search for extraterrestrial life, really that boils down to answering the question of, is there water where I'm looking? They don't look for organisms, they look for water, because without water, it doesn't even really make sense to think of life. Okay, now, in 16, we can see a water molecule and an ammonia molecule. But the same thing that's important about this slide would also be true of two water molecules, or two ammonia molecules, or two any two polar molecules. That's the formation of hydrogen bonds. Before I get back more into this particular example, let's think about nonpolar molecules, which we just said oxygen is, right? Oxygen is a nonpolar molecule because it's equal sharing. If you have trillions of oxygen molecules in a sample of gas, for instance, they don't care what the other oxygen molecule, each one individually doesn't care what the other oxygen molecules are doing. They're moving, so they might collide, bounce off of each other, but there is no attraction between them because there's no charge differences. Okay? But with a population of polar molecules, there is a slight attraction between them. And that's because each individual polar covalent bond is itself a polarization with respect to electrostatic charge. Just not a full charge, it's a partial charge. So when one polar molecule approaches another polar molecule, instead of just heading in their own direction like that other one's not even there, which nonpolar molecules would do, When they approach, they start to swivel in such a way that the slightly positive end of one polar molecule will face the slightly negative end of another polar molecule, because opposite charges attract each other. It's like very weak magnets, basically, only it's not magnetic force we're talking about here. But if you think about, you know, if you have a magnet in each of your hands and you move them quickly past each other, they're not going to stay there in place, but you can feel that force as you go by. Whereas if it's just two blocks of wood, you're not going to feel anything, right? No attraction. And therefore, this hydrogen bonding that occurs gives the population of molecules properties that it wouldn't have if the individual molecules were nonpolar. But it's called a hydrogen bond regardless of whether hydrogen is actually part of the molecule or not. It just often is. That's why it was originally called hydrogen bonding. Now, a hydrogen bond is not a chemical bond, because this does not make new stuff. In this example, you still have water the whole time and ammonia the whole time. It doesn't turn into some water-ammonia complex with new properties. It's not new substance. And in fact, it's not very long-lasting. It can be a tiny, tiny fraction of a second that this hydrogen bond is before it's broken again, because these things are moving, especially in the liquid or gas phase, moving pretty quickly. But and that's why I say when you're moving magnets past each other, it's not going to be a permanent keeping them in place, but it has an effect, more than nothing. Okay, now to 17. I don't want to talk a hell of a lot about this, but I want you to realize why certain molecules have shapes the way they do. Like a water molecule is a bent molecule. And it might make sense that to expect a water molecule to be a linear molecule with the hydrogens spaced out maximally from the on either side of the oxygen. Instead, though, the hydrogens are closer to each other on one side of the oxygen. That ends up making sense, though, as well, obviously, because of this tetrahedron, which is a four-sided plane figure, it has four faces, I should say. It's like a four-sided die in gaming. But it has four points to it, four corners overall as a solid, that those corners are as far apart from each other as they can be. If you put them in any other position, you'd have to get two of the corners closer to each other than they are now, right? So they're maximally spread out, the corners, in a tetrahedron. Well, the four corners of a tetrahedron are the positions of four orbitals we've been talking about within the shell. And remember, orbitals hold electrons. Electrons have the same charge. So you would expect those to be spaced out from each other, because like charges repel each other, not attract. Okay? Well, oxygen, when we draw it like this, the Lewis dot diagram, we can see all four orbitals. We've drawn them in a plane, but really they're in the four corners of a tetrahedron. And two of them are full orbitals, right? Those are electrons that are going to remain the property of that oxygen. And so two of the corners of the tetrahedron surrounding that oxygen nucleus are going to be occupied by full-time electrons of oxygen. The other two are the ones that are going to be shared with hydrogen. So those other two corners are where you're going to have hydrogen atoms. And when you calculate what the angle would be from a corner to the middle of the solid, the middle of the thickness of the die to another corner, it's the actual angle that oxygen molecule is. That's why it's like that. Eighteen is the last slide for this chapter, and it's a little bit of a change in topics. We're looking at some examples of signal molecules. A signal molecule in general is a molecule, I shouldn't really say necessarily molecule, it's a particle, signal particle. But a signal is something that causes something to happen in a cell that wouldn't happen if the signal were not present. And there's all kinds of different signals, but some of them are produced in our bodies, by our cells. And therefore, we classify those as endogenous signals. Gen, as in generate, means to create. Endo means within. There are also signals, though, that the body can't create on its own, but that will cause things to happen in the body if they're taken into the body. Those are called exogenous signals. Or at least that's one word we could call them. We usually don't bother to call them exogenous signals. We call them drugs. Something isn't classified as a drug if we can make it on our own. It's something that we put into the body that the body doesn't make that is a drug. Yeah.
Can you repeat
endogenous? Endogenous just by itself means occurring within. An endogenous signal is a signal that the body creates for its own use. The two signals we see at the top in cartoon form are endorphin and morphine, as you see here. And when you look at the full space-filling model for each of them, compare the two, you can see that endorphin is a fair amount different from morphine. It's a lot bigger and more complex than morphine. Unless you restrict your attention to just the part that's in the box and ignore the rest of the molecule. This brings up an important point about signals in general. No signal particle will have any effect unless and until that signal binds to a receptor molecule. And the receptor is some sort of protein. It's just one of the many important jobs that proteins do. They act as receptor molecules, much like a lock accepts a key. Notice that it's not the case that a key will work on just any lock. Unless you're trying it on the correct lock with the right shape for that key is going to do nothing. Similarly for a signal. You know, hormones are signals, for instance, and they get broadcast throughout the body because they get put into the bloodstream, so every living cell sees them, or is exposed to them, I should say. But only certain cells have any response to that because only the cells that have the right receptors to receive those signals will know that they're even there. And similarly, using the lock and key analogy, the only part of the key that really matters is the part that's inserted into the lock, right? You could have whatever shape you want as the handle. The key will still work if it's correct for that lock. That's exactly what's happening here with morphine versus endorphin. Endorphin is the endogenous signal. The body makes that, uses it as a signal. Morphine is a drug because the body doesn't create it, but it works within our bodies because the business end of the key, the part that actually fits into the receptor molecule, is the same as the real key, endorphin. Just has a different shaped handle, basically, which in the handle doesn't matter. Now, I might as well introduce the term since I'll use it several times coming up. Signal particles are just examples of ligands. Ligand is a much more general term. Another way of saying that is that all signal particles are ligands, but not all ligands are signal particles. There's ligands for other reasons as well. But the word ligate, the verb, means to tie or to bind to. And that's why ligands are so named. Ligands are particles that bind to proteins. And this is for various reasons, depends on the situation. But that's what makes something a ligand. It binds to a protein. And whenever that occurs, whether it's a signal or some other kind of ligand, the actual binding event, when the ligand binds to a protein, there is a change in the shape of that protein because of the binding. And therefore, there are consequences to that shape change. And this is why there are certain things happen in cells that have receptors, because those receptors have changed their shape when the signal comes along and binds to it. Well, the signal can be present in a different cell, and if it doesn't have the receptor, there's nothing to change shape, and therefore nothing happens. All right. Let's finish this chapter then and go to the next.